All right. Well, welcome to today's presentation on science and religion in conflict. So here's an overview of what I'd like to do today, and I do welcome discussions as we're doing this presentation as well. Just to remind you, what you say, you'll probably get into my recording, so, you know. But we're used to that, aren't we?
I don't care.
Yeah, despite that, Steve has said some of the best things in these recordings. We should pull them out from time to time. Best of CFN, you know? Okay, so I want to provide an overview of the major views and approaches to this issue of science and religion possibly in conflict. And this presentation is based on an article from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy called Conflicts Between Science and Religion by Bradley Sickler. Very easy to find. In fact, if you Google Conflicts Between Science and Religion, it's probably the first hit. Now, clearly, I cannot cover everything in the article, so it's really more like just that overview of, you know, points for us to get going and get thinking about it. Those of you who are interested in going to the lecture next week on this topic, I think this should serve as good background. In fact, it is entirely consistent with the goals of the CFN, where as Christian academics on this campus, we serve a kind of a resource role in shaping the worldview around us. And so it seems to me that it behooves us to be more educated than the average person about this topic, if we are to have that mission at all. All right, so here's an outline of the article itself. You know, just copy it straight from the table contents. It starts out with defining science, and then defining religion, and then three theories or approaches to this particular issue. One is called the hostility theory, a second, the harmony theory, and the third, the indifference theory. And within each of these theories, there's some discussion on some interesting aspects of these theories, and I'll try and go over some of them and not be able to go through them in detail. And then it ends with a concluding paragraph. All right, let's start with the notion of defining science. Now, this is a quote that comes from the article. Let me read it. Science aims at understanding the behavior of the natural world. Any propositions that are about supernatural objects or abstract universals or normative ethics should not be considered scientific, since they do not pertain to the study of natural empirical objects. Now, this is in some sense an attempt at defining science, but of course, as soon as he defines it this way, he starts to deconstruct it, you know, like all good philosophers do, and see that, well, you know, this is highly problematic, defining science in this way. Well, first of all, not every scientific claim is directly about empirical objects. For example, in science, we talk about the very nature of science itself, such as the claim that science should focus on the natural world, which itself is not an empirical object. However,
that define what you mean when you say empirical, because
things that you can essentially do experiments and get observations from. No, I mean the natural world is things you can infer, but the claim that you should only do that to the natural world is not. For example, the claim that you can only access the natural world is not an empirical claim, right?
How could you prove?
That's right. You cannot do an experiment to see whether or not the things that are not accessible are accessible or not, because clearly by definition, you know, etc., right? There are many claims that are funny like that. But they things that are scientific claims or that are called scientific claims are at the very least connected to or supportive of the investigation of nature and natural objects, including, you know, the example we just gave. So really what we have here is only a necessary condition for science, but not a sufficient condition for science. And in fact, it remains till today an elusive issue, exactly what a sufficient condition for science would be, and nobody's actually been able to successfully give one. Now, what about defining religion? Now, this is perhaps, you might think, easier. Religion can be understood in terms of either its practice or its propositional content. Now, by practice, we mean things like, you know, the rituals of religion, the rules, the things that people do as part of religious activities. And I suppose it's easy to distinguish these things from scientific activity. However, it's not so easy to distinguish propositional content from scientific claims. In fact, the potential of conflict between religion and science lies probably in its propositional content. Now, and so perhaps we want to think about how you might distinguish religious propositional content from scientific propositional content. Yeah, so exactly what are religious propositions? Now, in general, it's difficult to distinguish from scientific propositions. For example, one might say that, well, maybe religious content is about the metaphysical, while scientific content is about the empirical. But clearly, this is inadequate. In fact, probably flatly untrue. For example, the claim that, you know, Jesus' body was stolen from the tomb is not a metaphysical claim, and yet it is apparently a religious claim, or at least it's a proposition that's made in the context of religious activity. So that's not so simple to talk about. And similarly, there are claims that are apparently metaphysical that are scientific claims, such as claims about the natural world and so forth, that are not empirical, as we discussed a minute ago. How about the idea that maybe religious claims or religious propositions are focused on ethical issues? Now, even this is clearly not true, because there are scientific claims that seem to be focusing on ethical issues as well. And similarly, there are religious claims that are not about ethical issues, even though many of them are. Okay, let's talk about the three particular approaches to this issue of the conflict between science and religion, or at least the apparent conflict. The first is what is called the hostility theory. Now, in the hostility model, science and religion each make claims that the other side denies. Now, this is not to say that every claim that is scientific is denied by religion and vice versa, but they do make claims that the other side denies. And if this is the case, then if one claim is true, then the denial is false, which means that if there's a claim that science is one way and religion denies, then if science is true, then the religious claim is false, and vice versa. And this is why it's called the hostility theory, because in this model, science and religion are in this sort of tug of war for what exactly are true claims. Now, it often goes beyond that, in the sense that the opponent is considered not simply to be incorrect, but operating under great and dangerous delusions. Now, it turns out that you might be thinking that this only works one way, if you're thinking of, for example, the God delusion.
We ought to write a book called The Dawkins Delusion.
Which there is such a book already.
There is?
Oh, yes.
2-3 years.
That's right, Dawkins. Now, so it goes both ways, and let me read two quotes that comes directly from this article. The first is a speech given by the character Matthew Harrison Brady from Inherit the Wind, the movie about the famed Scopes trial. He says this: "I have been to their cities, and I have seen the altars upon which they sacrifice the futures of their children to the gods of science. And what are their rewards? Confusion and self-destruction. New ways to kill each other in wars. I tell you, gentlemen, the way of science is the way of darkness." And on the other side, here's a quote from Isaac Asimov in 1994 in the Canadian Atheist Newsletter. He says, "Imagine the people who believe that God exists and who are not ashamed to ignore totally all the patient findings of thinking minds through all the centuries since the Bible was written. And it is these ignorant people, the most uneducated, the most unimaginative, the most unthinking among us, who would make themselves the guides and leaders of us all. Who would force their feeble and childish beliefs on us? Who would invade our schools and libraries and homes? I personally resent it bitterly." Now, in this sort of tug of war, this hostility model, There have been several key historical flashpoints that are relevant to this way of thinking about the hostility between science and religion. And these are Copernicus, Galileo, and heliocentrism, Newton and mechanism, and finally Darwin and evolution. Perhaps these are the very historical flashpoints that you have in mind. Now in the first, and I'll just go over these real quickly, because you sort of know what they are. They're familiar. So heliocentrism is the idea that the planets in the solar system go around the sun, right, as opposed to geocentrism, where they all go around the Earth. Now, Copernicus, I guess, was the first to popularize the idea of heliocentrism. But his popularization of it, his documentation of it in a fairly well-known book or treatise called Revolutions or something like that. I forget what it's called. In that he proposes this model, but it's not really a true model, nor does it actually explain the data any better or anything like that, but it's a proposal nonetheless. Galileo, of course, had more empirical tools at hand, such as telescopes and so forth, which, you know, many of which he built himself. And he proposes that, hey, look, you know, based on empirical evidence, it seems more the way the motions of the planets are more easily explained in a heliocentric way. But still, it's not that the old way was not, or the Ptolemaic way did not explain it. It just explained it in a more complicated fashion. And the story goes, that the church sort of decides that, well, you know, there's not really that, you know, that much of a compelling reason to go along with this heliocentric thing. And since the Ptolemaic tradition, you know, has been around for a while and sort of fits better with the certain literal readings of the Bible, they thought, well, let's stick with the geocentric view for at least for now. But of course, this whole thing, you know, kind of, you know, goes virus, so to speak, in today's social networking lingo, and you know, the rest, as you know, is history. And next week's talk in the history department, I think we'll try and touch on this point from a historical point of view. Now, Newton and mechanism is perhaps a little bit easier to understand, because Newton was in some sense the first to create a whole success story out of mechanistic explanations. I mean, he wrote down, you know, very, very sort of general principles, for example, about motion, which in one fell swoop explains or reduces all kinds of models of motions of everything ranging from apples falling from trees to planetary motion. And this, you would think, would cause some sort of unrest in the church, because in some sense, you know, once you have very mechanistic things like that, explanations like that, then, you know, who needs God, right? And yet you will see very soon that this was not the case, at least for Newton himself personally. So there's something funny going on here, that it's not all as it would seem and more than meets the eye to this notion of giving mechanistic explanations to the world. And finally, of course, Darwin and evolution may be the most well-known of these flashpoints in history, causing a conflict between science and religion. Of course, the whole idea here is that if evolution and the Darwinian explanation is true, then, you know, do we really need a creation account? Of course, this is hotly debated, and the very question I raised immediately gives rise to answers of the strong, vehement yes and the strong, vehement no at the same time. Now, there's a common core, and this is a very interesting aspect of the way the article views this whole conflict. A central issue in this tug of war is the explanation of data. So the debate is not over what the data are, data being a plural word here, I'm sorry, but what they mean. Now, in this context, it is useful to bring up something called the Duhem-Quine thesis. This Duhem-Quine thesis states that scientific hypotheses do not come free-floating, which is to say that even scientists who do science do not do it in a vacuum. They bring to the table a lot of sort of prior knowledge, claims, beliefs, and so forth. Now, of course, the same is said to be true about religion as well. In fact, in particular, true about religion. But the interesting thing about the Duhem-Quine thesis is that that is said of science. Now, of course, this clearly also applies, and it does, seemingly so, to religious claims, and in particular to the interpretation of sacred texts. For example, why would it be that two sides having viewed the same evidence, or apparently the same evidence, you know, which you can find in libraries and so forth, come to such different conclusions about the evidence? So a particular case study is useful to present this idea. In the creation-evolution debate, it would appear that two sides are looking at the same data and yet coming to different conclusions. So an example of this data would be the fossil record. Now, the creationists would want to say that the data refute Darwinism and thereby evolutionary theory, and yet evolutionists would say that, well, the data refute, Darwin's background and assumption that evolution would take place slowly and gradually, but it doesn't necessarily refute evolution, as a more general principle of how life changes on Earth. So this is sort of a very funny predicament that we're in, perhaps explained by something like the Duhem-Quine thesis. Okay, the next model is called the harmony theory. And in the harmony model, science and religion are not hostile to each other at all, and they can, in fact, be harmonized. There are many examples of harmonization of science and religion in history, you know, ranging from Descartes, Newton, Pascal, Boyle, Kepler, Gassendi, and so forth, to, of course, the many, many Christian scientists living today, including those on our own campus and in our own midst at this very meeting. Now, the reformer John Calvin himself encouraged Christians to study nature through scientific investigation because, he claims, science was the study of God's handiwork. And through doing it, you harmonize what's in nature with what you know through your faith. Now, here's a quote written by Francis Bacon in Of Atheism, and this quote is very difficult to read because it is written in Old English. So what I'll do is I'll give you about 30 seconds to try and work through it yourself. And as you see, the whole gist of this quote by Francis Bacon is that if you look deeper into things, there's harmony instead of conflict between science and religious claims. I suppose in particular Christian religious claims. Finally, the indifference theory. And in the indifference theory, science and religion make declarations that are completely unrelated to each other. They cannot be in conflict because they're just indifferent to each other. They occupy different realms of claims. So one way of doing this separation is to say that science involves the classification of empirical observations, whereas religion is focused more on ethics, ritual, and propositions, for example, that the divine being exists, that have no empirical entailment. That's at least one way to try and divide the two. So they have sort of they occupy different worlds or different spheres, magisteria. Is that the right word? Karl Barth, in a letter to his niece, says this: "Has no one explained to you in your seminar that one can as little compare the biblical creation story and a scientific theory like that of evolution as one can compare, shall we say, an organ and a vacuum cleaner? That there can be as little question of harmony between as of contradiction." So in this theory, both the conflict model and the harmony model are just wrong. There can be no conflict, nor can there be harmony, because they're just talking about different things. Now, so here's a common dichotomy that is made. And this dichotomy is one of faith versus fact. So faith, so goes this common dichotomy, is belief without evidence, or belief in the presence of what should normally be taken as decisively refuting evidence, a rather skeptical way of putting things. Whereas fact has to do more with the tangible and the certain. And with this kind of dichotomy, religion is relegated to faith, while science to fact. Now, this kind of dichotomy is very familiar to us, because in some ways, and, you know, really it's so unfortunate that this is the case, the secular campus is divided in this very way. True? And it's because of that that people talk about this, you know, fact-value dichotomy, fact-faith dichotomy, and considered that sort of predicament is considered to be, in some sense, a crisis in the way we do business in the university. Now, no prizes for guessing which side of the university falls under, you know, the sort of values or faith side of things, and which side falls under the fact side of things. And it would appear, at least in some superficial way, that the fact side of things seems to have more clout than the faith side of things, in some sense marginalizing, you know, that side of the campus. A most unfortunate predicament. Now, let's try and understand this sort of faith versus fact dichotomy a little bit more carefully. Because when examined more carefully, it turns out that this is wrought with problems. It's just, it's not so easy. It's more than meets the eye if you look deeper into it. So this depiction is rife with difficulties. For example, let's ask the question, what exactly is a fact? Now, there are several attempts you might make to try and define what a fact is. So here are some attempts. F is a fact, means F is true. For example, you might say that. But that clearly is not a satisfactory way to define what a fact is, because what about an issue of faith like that God exists? If the proposition that God exists is true, and a fact means something that's true, then that would be a fact. And clearly, people who make this dichotomy between fact and faith would not agree with that, because they want to relegate a claim like God exists to faith. Correct? Okay, so maybe it's something like this. Well, to be a fact means it's true and it's obvious that it's true. Well, but this is still not satisfactory, because I think people recognize, for example, that, you know, let's say this table right here is mainly empty space. And they recognize that to be a fact, because you can read about that in, you know, science textbooks. And yet it's far from obviously true, right? Okay, how about this? F is true, and experts believe that F is true. Maybe only then does something get called a fact. Well, who are experts? There are religious experts too. And what about, you know, do they get a say in whether or not that thing is true? How about this? F is true and empirically verifiable. Well, that's also not particularly appealing to this discussion, because there are many scientific claims that are considered facts but are not empirically verifiable, and I think we've talked about a few of them. You know, for example, I think it's taken as a fact in science that the natural world is understandable and is governed by laws. But this is not empirically verifiable. If it is governed by a certain by laws, you can empirically verify whether a particular law fits the data or not. But whether or not it's governed by those laws cannot be empirically verified. Now, you might, of course, at this point, if you're not used to the discussions we've been having at CFN for 8 years now, sort of say, what do you mean by that? Come on. Look, I pick up my pen, right? It's empirically verifiable that the falling of the pen is governed by gravity. No, it's not. All I can verify is that every time I've dropped my pen for the last million times, it's fallen. But I have no evidence whatsoever that the next time I let it go, it will fall. True? I need some non-empirical assumptions, and those are considered facts in science. So that's funny. So what about, is science related to fact, really? And religion? What about religion? Is religion also related to fact in some cases? And you can see now the waters are pretty muddy, and we don't have a good way of dealing with this. Now, what about faith? What is faith? Now, so here again, we might have several attempts, and those attempts will also have difficulties. So, for example, you might say F is a matter of faith means F is not a fact, but again, this is clearly problematic. How about that F is unsupported by evidence? Again, problematic, because matters like, you know, that let's say Jesus rose from the dead is considered a matter of faith, and yet there is testimony evidence, there's evidence based on documents, and so forth, right? Maybe you don't consider those things to be good evidence, but still, there's evidence. Okay, how about we modify it this way? F is insufficiently supported by evidence. Oh, did I have a typo there? Insufficiently supported by evidence. Now, here the problem here is what the word insufficient means, right? Because it seems sufficient for some people, and yet not sufficient for others. So this being supported by evidence is not a good or reliable criterion. And finally, how about this? F is not universally agreed upon. Well, it is not universally agreed upon that this table is mainly empty space, and I bet everyone in this room agrees with it, but I guarantee you can find people out there who would not agree with that. Similarly, how about things like, you know, everything ranging from global warming to, you know, Archaeopteryx, you know, as an animal that had feathers in the past or something like that. So again, now we want to ask the question, so really, is religion and faith really the natural sort of partnership going on here? What about science and things that are considered matters of faith? Now, an example of this that's rather interesting, which if you go to the talk next week, I presume will be discussed even more, is the Galileo affair. See, one thing about the Galileo affair that maybe is not particularly well discussed is the fact that the Galileo proposal for heliocentrism was in fact not any more empirically verifiable or any more sort of in accord with the data prevailing at the time. The fact is that the Ptolemaic model equally explains the very same data, more in a more complicated way. So something else was at play here. And whatever else was at play here, it is a jumble of all kinds of things that have to do more with, you know, politics, you know, power, you know, and other things like that.
So I thought it was science has this body of literature that they say here's what we know. Hello, Jim. And here's what we understand to be facts.
Yeah.
Speed of light is the fastest speed we have, correct?
until last week or something.
Yeah, see? So what does that do to all the facts?
Right. They're all tentative, I suppose. Hold that thought.
See, I think at least the media has changed how they talk about science in my lifetime. I mean, I think I remember when science was not presented as fact. It was always presented as a tentative thing. You know, you heard about the theory of evolution, the theory of this, the theory of that.
Right.
And, you know, as a scientist,
yes,
we are always tentative about our conclusions. And
right.
So in some sense, we don't even believe that it's fact.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of theories that we have not disproven.
Yes.
Right?
Well, let me ask you this, Dan. Are there any facts? Are there facts?
Yes, yes, there are.
Give me an example of a fact.
That's one right there.
That there are facts?
I believe there are. So we can go out and take a look at the geology around us.
Yeah.
And we can probably agree on what we see.
Okay.
We can count and measure things that we observe, and we probably can agree, yes, that you're measuring it in a way that we would all agree on.
Okay.
You know, the background radiation, speed of light, you know. So, but
those
then how facts. Then how we organize those into theories and make theories out of them is what I think has changed maybe in the last 20, 30 years. People talk about things as fact when in reality there's lots of problems with all of our theories.
Yes.
And so...
What about, you know, the thing is that even simple observations are just, you know, in some sense you could say simple versions of those theories you're talking about. They're not elaborate. For example, I look in a telescope and I see a round object, you know, floating around, and it's there every night, and after a while I call it the moon, and after a while I'll make claims about the moon, like it's got craters on it, blah, 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 right? But in some sense, those are just very simple theories, because you can always poke holes in them, right? How do you know there wasn't a speck that was a moon-like thing on the end of my telescope? You know, did I clean it off properly, you know, et cetera, right? Well, but the other guy saw it too, maybe he's got the same speck, I don't know. You know, that anything you do, even things that you can see, are questionable. Maybe their eyes are, you know, right? Because after all, we can only see a certain spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. Maybe it's not what it seems, et cetera. True?
Well, yeah. I mean, our mechanisms for observing change is depending on what we're looking at.
Right.
And some things we require tools, I mean, that make it maybe less certain that what we're seeing is really what we think we're seeing.
Right.
And therefore what you're saying about, you know, well, it remains almost a theory of what the fact is.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So maybe fact, you know, so that's why it's hard to define what is a fact, right? So is it just that a claim becomes a fact when we're pretty sure? You know, then you say, well, how do you define pretty sure and when, you know, how come it's a fact for some people but not for others, you know, and so forth, right? There are still people who believe in a flat earth. Very few, but there are. It's not a fact to them that the earth is not flat, right? Etc. It's problematic, but let's keep this thing going. This discussion, let's see, what else is going on here? Oh, yeah, that's just, he ends with this conclusion, which, you know, it's a long paragraph, but essentially what it says is that the relationship between science and religion is frequently commented on but rarely understood with clarity. In other words, the debate rages on. We still don't know what we're talking about, and we're still going to be fighting about it. But it's nonetheless clearly a very important issue for us here, right, on a secular campus. Steve has another comment now.
Is it a fact that we don't understand, or do we take that by faith?
Yes.
Would you all please help me?
I don't know. We got nothing from these guys here, man.
Those are the bright ones.
Yeah, Yeah, I just tend to agree with Dan, right? With his comments about science is not really. I think, in fluid mechanics, right? We all know about turbulence, right?
Yes.
The current, there's no real theory there yet. It's all hypothesis, and we work around those hypotheses, and nobody has even conclusively shown it. But that, so I don't think anybody's claiming that this is a fact on how turbulent flows work. So, yeah, I think I can begin to see why science is not really facts. I'm just saying that in agreement with our discussion.
Is there such a thing as turbulence?
Well, it's the name we give it. You know, you can interpret it another way. Now you can even argue, is turbulence a fact?
How about fluid? Is there such a thing as a fluid?
Well, if you agree with the definition of a fluid, then yes.
So you're saying that's a fact?
Well, that's the way we... I think then we can even begin to question any terminology we give, right? So within the parameters of that, I think science operates so, but... Yeah.
So I have a question for political science. Does the distribution of various faiths, whether Jewish, Christian, whatever, predict voting patterns?
Absolutely.
So that's been studied.
And Kim says?
A ton, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's different versions of that, too. Like, actual... like religious identity predicts it, but so does how often you're in a place of worship, and although there's variation within those too, but all of that predicts whether you're going to vote and who you're going to vote for.
So are there models that would already predict 2012? On a national state?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that more and more the population is self-identifying as secular or spiritual but not religious, and they're a little, we don't know enough about them yet to be able to make good predictions of what, I mean, we know that they're less likely to vote and those kind of things, but.
So when can you give us a firm prediction?
we would need to have a Republican nominee first, at least. So,
who do you predict that is?
I don't know. We have lots of that kind of stuff. And actually, that's sort of interesting. This conversation is really interesting because, at least in political science, and I think this is true in other social sciences, we tend to hold up the hard sciences as being super fast, fact-based, and determinative. I mean, I even teach my graduate students, right, that social sciences are non-determinative laws. Right, they're probabilistic laws of human behavior, and we can't actually predict with 100% certainty what everybody's going to do, but we want to because we want to be like physics and chemistry. But I know, I mean, even from talking to you guys, but I know this is true from other things too, that what we call hard science is not as
yes.
You know, sure about everything as we both portray it and act like it is.
Yes. That's why this thing is a false dichotomy,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, which is why we appreciate having people, for example, political scientists in our midst. Otherwise, you know, we'll just end up here with a bunch of scientists. Hard scientists, so to speak, mm-hmm. and you know.
Well, Brian's in psychology,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I'm not a real scientist.
Wait, let's go.
No, don't get that on tape.
By the way, Terry Gray says that I'm not a real scientist, as in me, because of the talks I've given on this topic. And those of you who have heard me talk about, you know, my own philosophy of science and the philosophy of science in my sub-discipline is one of what might be called scientific non-realism, where the claims of science are not meant to be true propositions. It's one form of philosophy of science. And it sounds to me like a whole bunch of people here who have similar backgrounds to me have similar views about science, too. True? Like Karan, obviously, sounds like he does.
I will say, it is... This is annoying, this thing.
Blame Jim, man.
I will. It's hard not to think probabilistically, right? So
I think, you know, I can say there are facts. I believe, I guess as a matter of faith, that there does exist some reality that really is true apart from my ability to know it, right?
That's what a fact is?
Well, I don't know. I just said that I believe, so there's faith involved, but I can say as a matter of faith that I believe there are real things, right? But then the tricky thing is the epistemology of it, right? So how can we say that something is a fact with what degree of certainty? And in psychology, kind of like what you're saying, you know, we talk about the scientific method we apply, and in order to do that, we have to assume certain things, like there are these cause-effect laws, but there's so much error, mm-hmm. You know, in what we try to measure things. We know there's error. We have ways to model error, mm-hmm. you know. But part of what I'm hearing you say is maybe, because, yeah, like we talk about physics envy and stuff like that, where... But wouldn't it be nice if we could assess something with a blood test instead of self-report and mm-hmm. stuff like this? What I'm hearing you say is that, you know, that just gives the illusion that we are assessing something with true precision. That
yes.
Just because we've shown it every single time in the past doesn't mean we have any evidence that we'll show it next time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is this just a is this just an epistemological issue that, you know, we can talk about fact as something that exists and maybe different approaches to knowing it can get us closer, but nothing can give us certainty?
Yes. By the way, do you have physics envy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that. Confession. Yeah.
Sure.
Confessions of a psychologist.
I think all social scientists do
that. Huh?
All social scientists do.
All socials? You too?
Oh, yeah. Well, we also have economics envy.
Okay.
Wait.
Wait, hang on. One more. Lumina? No. Physics envy?
No, I don't.
No? Ah, you liar.
David, coming from the industry for 30 years and coming into academics last four, when I see our finance and economic professors get excited about a model that has an adjusted R-squared of 10%, but their T-stats are very significant, I go, who cares? You still can't explain 90% of what the variance is. So why are you excited about 10%? You know? You just can't. So anyway, that's...
Man, that was nerd alert talk right there.
R squared values.
No, I just throw it into an artificial intelligence model until it comes up with, you know, a 99% R squared.
You know, to go back to Brian's question about, well, we're not that certain, but maybe we're coming closer and closer, right? In some views of science, we're not even doing that. All we're doing is explaining more and more data. But at points in time, we may have so much data that to, at that point, explain it all, we have to change the very nature of the model that explains that data, and that's what people call paradigm shift. And if that's really the nature of science, then we're not actually getting any closer to the truth, right? We're just explaining more and more data. And the very objects in the explanation are not meant to be true things. They're just internal objects within the explanation. And I think that might reflect basically Karan's, you know, point about, you know, what's turbulence and fluids and all that kind of stuff, right? Those are just words that are used for certain things, and that maybe down the road we will not use those words anymore. Do you believe that, Karan?
I don't know.
What if I weren't recording this? Would you know?
No. Those have been around for many hundreds of years, right? But
right.
But still, bottom line is, you're right. I mean, it's kind of a moving target, right? If you think of it, right? We are gaining more and more insights onto a problem, and right. So as we learn more about it, we might say, like you kind of nicely summed it up, there might be a paradigm shift in the way we think. We got it all wrong. You know, hang on. And those are moments are very rare in science these days. But
yeah. But you think they might even happen in your own field?
It's possible, yeah.
Okay.
Right. Proverbs, there's one that says, it's the glory of God to conceal a matter, it's the glory of man to search it out. And I sometimes think of the new heaven and new earth as God's going to say, I just created a new galaxy. Steve, good luck. Go figure it out. And I'll see you in a billion years, you know? I said the billion years just for Jim's sake.
Okay.
So
it sounds to me like...
I think that even in the new heaven and earth, we're still going to have to learn. You know, I think it would be great for us to use our minds just to figure out what creation is. So it may never come to be, except we don't need faith then. Right?
Wait, what do you mean? So all we have is science at that point?
Yes.
You have physics envy.
No.
You want to be an astronomer in the new heaven.
I do. But I'm not envious of that right now.
I think of the new heaven where everything will be revealed. Right? All the searching. Now we can know what the true fact is.
Yeah, that could be.
That's interesting.
Well, what do you think? Are there any other comments before we...
I just have one comment
Come on.
But you define faith, right?
Define
faith. So we should go back also and see what the Bible says about faith. And Hebrews 11:1 says,
yes,
faith is the evidence of... is the substance of things not seen.
And
I'm defining it wrongly. But it says it's the evidence of things hoped for, right? In some sense. It says... So the Bible defines faith exactly the way... this article defines it too, right? So it's faith really, I think it's consistent with all our discussion here. And I don't see this divide is necessary because it's...
The article shows is that it's hard to pin it down. Because even the particular verse in Hebrews, right, uses words that one might ask, what do those words mean? For example, evidence of things...
not seen. That's what it says.
Hebrews. I think it says hoped for. The not seen was the first part, right? So you ask, what does it mean for something to be not seen? And second, what's evidence mean? And what does it mean to hope for something, right? Now you get into all kinds of, maybe evidence means things that you can see. But the guy just said not seen, so what's going on?
Yeah.
So what's an evidence then?
Yeah.
Right? Et cetera, et cetera. And what does it mean for something not to be seen? Does that mean inaccessible to science? Is that what it means?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Yeah. You're an academic, aren't you?
Or a politician. Maybe I have a better future there.
you want the right wording?
The
New International Version.
Okay.
Well, here, I'll look up the version everybody's thinking of.
Oh, it's okay. No, the NIV is good, right? What's wrong with NIV?
Faith is the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance about what we do not see.
Ah, the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance in what we do. Well, first of all, this is a particular translation, and the translators already have rendered, you know, certain words in a particular way. For example, I don't see the word evidence here anymore.
This one is which version?
That was the
NIV.
International.
The one version is...
Is that the NIV?
Substance of things hoped for and evidence of things not seen.
Yeah.
Sure, what we hope for and certain of what we do not see.
What version is that?
NIV.
And... What, you guys have different NIVs?
Here's the King James.
Oh, no.
Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
Okay. Quran is the King James man.
No, this is how I remembered it. I don't read this
word. Really? Look, if it's good enough for St. Paul, it's good enough for us.
All right, so a question for the management professor. Science and religion, game theory, non-zero, zero-sum game.
I'm not answering that question. I don't think I'll answer.
Yes, Lumina has an answer to that question.
I do not. But I would like to talk more about the evidence of things not seen.
Okay.
I think... that is more about things that are not visible to our eyes,
mm-hmm.
things that we are not experiencing now, but we have the confidence that we will see something different and we will experience something different. I guess that's what it is, right?
Well, I don't know. You're asking me.
I mean, no, I'm guessing I'm...
Yeah.
You have to speak in King James.
Yes. Then only I will understand.
Then
you know.
You need marriage counseling.
But that's the challenge, right? Because that if you go on further in that chapter in Hebrews, right, it says that when you come with that faith that you already know that He rewards, right? So so there is so much depth in that six verses if you read there, right? And then the discussion, if you go and talk to somebody who doesn't believe in that, then it's a whole different question, right? It's like you can't verify this, you can't do that, and so on.
Yes.
Well, this was all excellent discussion. We have come to the end of our hour here. Thank you all for participating in this, and for those of you who are listening, we hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you.